Okay. Spiritual direction.
Does it look like we're working?
So can we reassemble, please, for the last? Once more into the reach. The epilogue. So we'll just work from the notes, and I'll take off whenever I feel like cheating off or something, or you can stop there at any point. But this is the final part of the book. You know, he had to end the book rather quickly. God only knows how long it would have been. If that hadn't been the case, but he was called to Rome to teach at the Gregorian. He wasn't expecting that, and he was, so he quickly rounded it off. But he really wanted to do his work on method in theology as part of this, and this was only leading up to that. But it's a good thing that he waited, because as we'll see at the very end, the whole thing got transformed in tremendous continuity, and yet in a way that none of us could have foreseen. Starting around 1965, February of 1965. So anyway, the epilogue then rounds it off for now. The epilogue does not provide a summary. The long-suffering reader, he said, is entitled to expect a summary, but I'm not going to give you one. The book was written from a moving viewpoint, and it's part of the assumption there is we're still moving on. Successive contexts have been formed only to provide the base and the need for forming a further, fuller context. And the process is not ended yet. So as he says at the end of, as he says at the beginning of the epilogue, he ended chapter 20 with a question. You know, what is this solution? Where is it? And it's a question at once too basic and too detailed to admit a brief answer. So he could only provide a heuristic structure for answering that question. The answer would be in the form of a doctrinal theology, as he puts it, quoting Augustine, intellectus querens fidem, understanding seeking faith, and a systematic theology, which is faith seeking understanding, doctrines and systematics. So where are we then? Well, this is what he says. From a succession of lower contexts, there was gradually to emerge an upper context. The upper context emerged, first of all, in chapter 11, experience, understanding, judgment, not subject to fundamental revision. The upper context, the lower contexts were to be subject to further additions and to indefinite revision. The upper context was to be constituted, one, by the invariant structures of experiencing, inquiring, and reflecting. Experience, understanding, chapter 11. Two, by the isomorphic structures of all there is to be known of the universe of proportionate being, potency, form, act. Isomorphic, experiencing, understanding, and judging. Three, by the fuller invariant structure that adds reasonable choice and action to intelligent and reasonable knowing. Four, by the profounder structure of knowing and known to be reached by acknowledging the full significance of the detached, disinterested, unrestricted desire to know, and there he's referring to God. And five, by the structure of the process in which the existential situation sets human intelligence the problem of rising above its native resources and seeking the divine solution to our incapacity for sustained development. What's isomorphic here is the good and grace. Establishing an isomorphism all along the way. Okay, does this process offer any contribution to the higher collaboration that he spoke of in chapter 20? That's the topic of the epilogue. What contribution does the whole book, Insight, make, particularly to theology, as a part of this collaboration with God in working out God's work in the world? And he divides his answer to that into five major divisions. We'll discuss these first, just as he presents them here. I'll occasionally make reference to later developments. And then I want to end the course with a brief presentation of the sea change that his whole notion of theology underwent in 1965, because we'll see with that change The contribution of insight is even more important than he envisaged when he finished the book. First of all, then, in this book itself, he feels that he has made a contribution to the introduction to theology, or what in those days was called apologetics, in the sense that the book offers a synthesis of reason and faith, and it gives evidence that they can work together. I think there's no Catholic theologian of the 20th century who was more familiar with modern science than Luther, and deeply respectful of its commitment to understand the universe, but also knowledgeably respectful. He knew it. He understood. He had a natural mathematical mind, and he understood mathematics, and he understood science, and what Einstein was about, and so on and so forth, in ways that most of us still have to catch up with. And most other Catholic theologians are not close to it, if any, in terms of his informed knowledge of what was going on in modern science. And yet, this full conviction that there was no conflict between the scientific enterprise and religion. The difficulty in the disputes between religion and scientific reason, he says, are to be traced by and large to an insufficiently supple and detailed cognitional theory. And so the book is an attempt to solve that problem by getting at cognitional theory. What are we doing when we're not? The cognitional theory of this book enables us to accept the positive element in rationalism, which is the desire to know. Insistence that we can raise further questions, and we can continue to raise them, and we must until we're satisfied, while reversing the opposition between the exigences of the mind and the claims of religion. It also enables us, this cognitional theory, to acknowledge the de facto limitations of human development without succumbing to an irrationalist religiosity, where faith simply becomes a leap into the absurd. But the self-transcendence of faith has the same type of structure as empirical science. Just as empirical scientists have to believe what is rationally and reasonably communicated to them by people who have reliable knowledge, so Lonergan is presenting religious belief here as a matter of the acceptance of reliably communicated knowledge. It's the same kind of structure as functions in empirical science itself. And finally, the balance of initiative in alleged conflicts between science and the metaphysical tradition, is somewhat redressed. I think it's tremendously redressed, actually, if metaphysics becomes reconceived as the invariant form for which the sciences provide the variable matter or content. The content is the sciences, metaphysics provides the form, quotes and format, structure. Then there's no dispute between metaphysics conceived in that way and full devotion to the scientific enterprise. And if dialectical analysis enables us to distinguish genuine scientific discoveries from their counterpositional formulation, in other words, there's nothing in science that necessitates a materialism or word for it, a determinism, mechanist determinism. All right, so that's a contribution, then, the first contribution, that he feels that this book does enable science and an intelligently informed religion to work together without any conflict. Second, he says there is a remote, but I'm going to argue later when we get into the functional specialties that it's far less remote than he realized at this time, but he says there's a remote but fruitful contribution that the book makes to the method of theology. And he gives a number of points. I think I've got six of them here. Yeah. First of all, the opposition between positions and counterpositions lays bare the roots of pietist and modernist revolt against dogma. Lonergan is quite committed to dogma as understood by the First Vatican Council. The dogma is the articulation of mysteries that are hidden in God that we could not know unless they were revealed. And he was quite committed to dogma understood in that sense. articulation of mysteries hidden in God that we could not know unless they were revealed. So Trinity, Incarnation, Mary and God, Muslim, and so on. The opposition, the roots of Pietist and Modernist revolt against dogma, the basis of the revolt is to place all truth in experience and not to acknowledge that truth is in judgment. This is his understanding of Pietism and Modernism, that for both of those, Pietism in Protestantism and Modernism in Catholicism, experience is the criterion of truth, whereas in this cognition of theory, judgment is where truth is arrived at. Dogmas are judgments. They're judgments that are certainly not unrelated to the religious experience of the community, but they are judgments. And the truth that they express, for instance, the truth of the homoousion of Nicaea, that the same things are to be said of the Son as are said of the Father, except that one is Father and the other is Son. Everything else, every other predication, everything is the same. Okay, that's not a particularly exciting experience from an experiential point of view. It's not. It's not. You're not going to pray a lot about that. It can inform your prayer, but it's not the kind of thing that arouses the intensity of religious experience. But that doesn't make it not true. It's a judgment, and the truth is in the judgment. And it's a judgment that flows from the community's experience of what Jesus meant. And it's, if Hengel, Martin Hengel, and N.T. Wright are correct, the community came to those convictions with regard to Jesus very early on, by 50 or 55. The convictions that ultimately gave rise to the Nicene and Chalcedonian dogmas. Secondly, the same dialectical technique that cuts short the disputed questions of metaphysics can contribute to the demise of some disputed questions in theology. All the centuries of theology where theologians were worried about other possible worlds, and Modernism said, I don't care about other possible worlds. I'm having a hard enough time understanding this one. And all these disputes about what would happen in other possible worlds. Who cares? The clarification of the role of understanding, thirdly, will promote the limited but fruitful understanding of the mysteries of faith applauded by the First Vatican Council. Lonergan's understanding of systematic theology comes from the First Vatican Council, where the First Vatican Council encouraged the understanding of the mystery. So the role, the principal function of systematic theology is not to establish the mysteries, but to understand mysteries that are already assented to. And so the clarification of the role of understanding in this book, he feels, well, if people can value understanding a little bit more as a result of reading this, then perhaps they will understand and value better what the First Vatican Council recommends, that theology's main, systematic theology's principal function is to try to understand the mysteries of faith. Fourthly, the metaphysics of proportionate being, precisely as proportionate, allows the theologian to understand this world without an explanatory account of other possible worlds. I used that as an example for an earlier chapter. He makes it explicit here. And this is an interesting point from my standpoint of reading Lonergan. It frees theology. When this metaphysics of potency form act is understood as a metaphysics of proportionate being, of created being, of this universe, excuse me, it frees theology from the necessity of reducing to the metaphysical elements the supernatural reality of the incarnation, the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, and the beatific vision. So, in other words, we can develop a more existential approach to Christology, to Trinitarian theology, to grace, and to eschatology, more existential and less metaphysical. Because potency, form, act are referring to this world, and these realities are God's entrance into this world, but perhaps there's another set of categories that can be used better to understand them. Now, I must admit that in Lonergan's own theology, which he was teaching at the same time that he was writing this book, he was still talking about those realities in these metaphysical categories. But he had no choice. That was the context of the scholasticism of his day. And he had to enter into that. And what he did with it was transform it from within so that it's an intelligent approach to it. But what he's trying to do here is to say, you know, we can actually get liberated from this. And we can talk about the incarnation, the indwelling of the Holy Spirit, the gift of the Holy Spirit, and the gift of eternal life, in ways that don't have to rely on these metaphysical categories at all. Fifthly, he says, a reasoned answer can be provided from this book for the question of whether there can be more than one true metaphysics. He would say that any true metaphysical statement is a contribution to the one metaphysics. Because if experience, understanding, judgment is the invariant structure of human knowing, then potency, form, act, or whatever language you want to use for the contents of each of those would be the invariant structure of the knowing. And so that does make not a lockstep kind of thing, because it's so wide open, but it provides a horizon within which metaphysical statements that would contradict this, really contradict it, not seemingly, but really contradict, would have to say that they would be problematic. So it's the isomorphism between knowing and known that allows him to make the statement that there is really one metaphysics, but that one metaphysics, I think we have to say, can be articulated in language other than what he's using here. He's using a language which is specific to a cultural tradition. And finally, there's a basis for an adequate solution to the question of changeless concepts. We have to think back here to the context of the church and theology of his day. Semper Idem, Cardinal Ottaviani's motto. Cardinal Ottaviani was in the same position in those days that Cardinal Ratzinger is in today. Always the same. Changeless concepts. Well, Lonergan says, well, concepts do change, you know. If things change, then the concepts about them change. If concepts flow from understanding and understanding develops, concepts are going to change. So there are ways in which the church, in its extremely conservative position in those days, even more so than it is today, can be persuaded, if this book can make any inroads into the ecclesiastical mind, can be persuaded to move away from the semper idem with regard to concepts. Still, behind every change, you don't have to fear that you're throwing out the baby with the bathwater. There is an underlying unity, and that unity may be formulated explicitly on the level of heuristic anticipation, or consciously adopted method, or a dialectical metaphysics. Hence, it follows that changes in conceptualization do not imply any ultimate multiplicity, reductionism, relativism, and that behind any conceptual variation, there can be a conceptual constant in the heuristic question that can be formulated from the universal point. Okay, so he's being very careful here, trying to avoid semper idem coming after him. But at the same time, also trying to avoid falling into the trap. All right. Any questions up to this point? This is still in the theological context of his own time, but it gives us a feel for what they were dealing with and how careful they had to be. He actually is reported to have said that if he had written Insight in Latin, they probably would have come after him. They probably would have read it and come after him. Thirdly, Vatican I's affirmation, of the identity of doctrinal meaning, not only in difference but also in development, confers a theological relevance on the book's analysis of development and its discussion of the truth of interpretation. So now he's lifting up the whole discussion of interpretation and development into a theological context. First of all, he takes interpretation. Just as true interpretation, so church teaching and or theology can present the same doctrine and the same meaning over time through a diversity of conceptualizations and expressions. Theology can extend its metaphysics into systematic theology, And the church can distinguish degrees of authoritativeness in its pronouncements. And with the universal viewpoint, the theologian can work out an adequate interpretation of past utterances. Secondly, with regard to development. In the individual, first of all, the advent of the absolutely supernatural solution, charity, hope, faith, the advent of that solution to our problem of evil, adds to the biological, psychic, and intellectual levels of development a fourth level of development that includes these higher conjugate forms of faith, hope, and charity. So not only do we grow biologically, not only do we grow psychologically and intellectually, we also grow in grace, just as Jesus himself is said to have grown in grace before God. What grace meant there may not be, however, exactly the same as what it means here. In themselves, these constitute an absolutely supernatural living that advances toward an absolutely supernatural goal, the beatific vision, under the action of grace. But in relation to other human, intellectual, and volitional activities, they are anticipated. These gifts are anticipated. We're waiting for them, in the sense we're waiting for God. Inasmuch as our rational self-consciousness adverts to its need for a divine solution, even as Heidegger is reported to have said, as he did say, only a God can save us. That's that anticipation. And they constitute a dialectical higher integration by making possible the sustained development of rational self-consciousness, reversing counterpositions and overcoming evil through good. They call forth charity, hope, and faith. They call forth their own development by giving rise to an advance in understanding, knowledge, and wisdom by which we grasp and apply the solution to human living in all its aspects. So as we go on living in this life, and making applications of this new life of grace, it is operating its own development as we keep applying it to ever new situations, as we keep investigating its meaning in different ways, through theology, through prayer, through retreats, whatever. It's operating its own development, and we grow. We grow in love, we grow in hope, we grow in faith, we grow in the ability to respond, to be self-transcendent. In relation to human sensitivity and intersubjectivity, these supernatural forms of charity, hope, and faith are announced through signs that communicate the gospel. So, good liturgy, good preaching, announcing this gift. They constitute a new psychic integration through affective contemplation of the mystery of Christ in the church, the Ignatian exercises. They call forth their own development again by intensifying our intersubjective awareness of human suffering and need. See what's going on in Africa today with AIDS and other problems. We become more aware of the growth that we're called to and our own response to human suffering and need. Not only there. This transformation of sensitivity and intersubjectivity penetrates to the physiological level, where the clearest instances appear in mystical experience. We've got transformations that are bodily, and some of them quite dramatic, but still in other lesser ways, through anagogic dreams that I think there are some dreams that come from God, penetrating right to the physiological level, giving rise to symbols that enable us to live and carry us forward. The four-leveled integration, bodily, psychic, intellectual, and supernatural, must be harmonious, but of course it can be laden with conflict. And also development in history. There's also a cumulative historical development. And here, Lonergan's anticipating a new theology of the church, and it's one that 50 years later has yet to be written. But he's anticipating it here, a cumulative historical development in the emergent trend and in the church, both in themselves and in the order of the universe. And he's suggesting here that in addition to liberal, Hegelian, and Marxist theories of history, there's needed a theory of humankind in the concrete and cumulative consequences of the acceptance or rejection of the gospel, the theology of history. Ultimately, I will want to say, and he's pointing in this direction, that history's going to be the provide the framework within which all of the doctrines and mysteries of the faith have to be understood. They have to be understood in terms of history. I want to take my own point is to take the four-point hypothesis of the four divine relations and the four created participations and put those into, relate them to a theory of mystery. And this would give you what I call the unified field structure for a systematic theology. The combination of that four-point hypothesis from the De Trino of the four divine relations and the four supernatural participations in God's own life, linked up with the theory of history, where history is understood in terms of vital, social, cultural, personal, and religious values. This is religious value here, influencing development on all of those levels. And we've got, from all of that, I think you can develop a full-scale systematic theology on that basis. So that theory that he's talking about here is the kind of thing that I'm attempting to do, or at least to start, in theology and the dialectics of history. And he says that it would form perhaps the formal element in the systematics of the church as mystical body of Christ. It would envisage not only natural and intelligent progress, but also sinful decline, and not only progress and decline, but also supernatural recovery. So he's calling here for a theory of history, a theology of history, and locating the church and its work within a theory of history. Okay, one more big point, one small point, and then I want to do a little quick overview of functional specialties to show you how much more approximate the influence of this book became on his later work than he could have envisaged at this time. Fourthly, the book makes a contribution, and this is a very important point. No one else has stated this, I don't think, as clearly as he does in this fourth point. A contribution to the relation of theology to the other sciences, and especially the human sciences, whose development has created a fundamentally new problem. There was no autonomous human science of psychology, sociology, anthropology, economics in the Middle Ages. There were no autonomous sciences in those days. Insofar as these sciences consider human beings in their concrete performance, not in the abstract, but in their concrete performance, they are treating theological realities. They are treating manifestations not only of human nature, but also of human sin. They're dealing with those. Of our de facto need of grace, of the reception of grace, and of its acceptance or rejection. Those sciences cannot exclude a priori, a theological component. Empirical human science cannot analyze successfully the elements in its object, namely us, without appealing to theology. Inversely, theologians have to take a professional interest in the human sciences and make a positive contribution to their methodology. That is a statement right out of Insight. And that was, in those days, for someone to link up theology that closely with psychology, sociology, anthropology, cultural theory, economics was unheard of. That those sciences can't function without taking into account a theological element, and theologians have to be professionally interested in the human sciences and make a positive contribution to their methodology. And the same holds for the relation of theology to philosophy insofar as philosophy has become existentialist, dealing with human beings as they concretely are. In large measure, he says, these are the problems that have dictated the structure of this book. Theology has a universal relevance, yet there are independent inquiries, other sciences, that can reach valid conclusions from their own resources. And for that reason, the first 18 chapters proceeded with no indication of theological components. And the last two revealed the inevitability with which the affirmation of God and the search of intelligence for faith arise out of sincere acceptance of scientific presuppositions and precepts. Not only is there no opposition, science feeds right into an intelligent acceptance of God's existence. Then he goes on to list three possible modes of relevance of theology to empirical science. First of all, for the scientist, insofar as the pure desire to understand correctly is open to a variety of interferences that ultimately can be surmounted only by accepting the ultimate implications of the unrestricted desire. That is so different from the way religion has been used to shut off the pure desire. And here he's saying authentic religion opens it up, keeps it alive. Secondly, there is a relevance to the correct interpretation of empirical human science by adding the manner in which we can remedy the evil in our situation, by returning good for evil. The systematic treatment in empirical human science can become practical only through theology. And the relentless modern drift to social engineering and totalitarian controls is the fruit of human effort to make human science practical without God and the divine solution to the problem of evil. Thirdly, because of the theologian's grasp of the desire to know as a desire for God, theology can encourage scientists to complete fidelity to their calling and teach non-scientists the high office of the scientific spirit, and can encourage science out of mechanist determinism into a genetic method based on universally valid principles and a dialectical method to enlighten people regarding the constituents of reason. Finally, in this epilogue, he says that the book makes a contribution to the program of Leo XIII in Aeterni Patris, the encyclical Leo XIII, Aeterni Patris, where Leo, this was a tremendous inspiration for Lonergan as a Jesuit and as a person really devoted to the papacy and to the church and so on. The program that Leo XIII stated there, Vetera Novus, Augere et Perficere, and he really took this in his early life as what he was called to do, to augment and complete Perficere, the old with the new. To augment and complete the old with the new. The old he studied in his studies of Aquinas on grace and freedom and verum. So in grace and freedom, he's studying Thomas on the supernatural and its relationship to human freedom. And in verum, he's studying Aquinas' cognitional theory. He said he spent 11 years trying to figure out what the old really were. If the old here is Aquinas as the principal theologian influencing Catholic theology. And then the new is this book, okay, to augment and complete the old with the new, mathematics, modern science, Marx, Freud, and alchemy. So it's a contribution to that program that Leo set out, Leo XIII, to augment and complete the old with the new. Now, what I want to do to finish off is the functional specialties for method and theology, because if you are interested, finally, in the question, what's the impact of the book Insight on theology, this is the root of the answer. But he only arrived at this in February of 1965. So, well, long after he finished writing Insight, and while he was recovering from very serious surgery and beginning his work on method and theology. If there are four levels of consciousness, of intentional experiencing, understanding, judgment, and decision, and if there are two phases to theology, the first phase in which theology listens to the past and appropriates the past, the first phase could be called, in general, the hermeneutical phase, in which we interpret what others have said and done. And the second phase, in which we stand in the present and say what we want to say, where the theologian stands on his or her own two feet and is no longer reporting what others have said, but is saying what I have to say. The second phase, direct discourse. So if there are four levels of consciousness and two phases to theology, then the entire theological enterprise, I was present when he first went public with this, and it was electrifying to us, the entire enterprise can be all the operations that are performed in the theological community. This is not any one theologian performing all of them, but in the theological community, can be divided into research, corresponding to experience, because it makes the data available. So archaeological digs, texts, making critical texts available, research. Research makes the data available. Interpretation. understanding the data that have been made available. So corresponding to understanding in the first phase is interpretation, making understanding the data that have been made available. But understanding is, the data are cumulative and over time, and something's going forward. And history is the functional specialty or the operational specialty within theology that corresponds to judgment and that asks and answers the question, what was going forward as successive data are being left behind and successive texts are being written and so on and so forth. And then out of all of this, in this whole movement, and in the interpretation and history of this whole movement, there will be conflicts. So we will find conflicts in the history, and there will be conflicts today in the history and interpretation of the past. And those conflicts, calling for decision, are dealt with in the functional specialty of dialectic. They're confronted in the functional specialty of dialectic, where each one of us has to make a decision as to which conflicts are really not all that serious and possibly can be shown to be complementary or genetically related to each other, and which of them are dialectical in the sense of contradiction. A very recent development in the ecumenical dialogue in the United States in particular on this, I think, is the Lutheran Roman Catholic Agreement on Justification by Faith, where what had divided these traditions for four centuries is now seeing, well, you know, if we really understand what each tradition is saying in its authenticity, we can live with those differences. They're really not about that serious. That's dialectic at its best, reducing the differences to what lies behind them and reducing the differences to the real question of whether or not one side is rooted in authenticity and the other side in inauthenticity. And what they came to in these conclusions up to this point is we can't make those judgments. We can't pass that kind of a judgment on the other side. There's integrity on both sides. And really, the differences are not all that divisive. All right, that's dialectic doing its work and finding out that there may not really be dialectical differences between the Lutheran and Roman Catholic positions of justification. And I don't think there are. Now, that was all led up to by work that Karl Barth did and that Hans Krumsey from a Catholic standpoint in the 20th century. Hans Krumsey's original doctoral dissertation was on justification. That was his basic position. All right, so that's the tradition, studying the tradition, theology, receiving from the past into the present, bringing theology from the past into the present. Research, interpretation, history, dialectic, corresponding respectively to experience, understanding, judgment, and decision. This doesn't mean the only thing you do in research is experience. No. But all of your operations are heading towards the goal of experience, namely data. All of your operations in interpretation, where you've got to make judgments and you've got to make decisions and so on and so forth, but you're headed towards understanding. In history, you're headed towards the judgment of what was happening. And in dialectic, you're headed towards a decision as to what are serious conflicts and what are really not all that serious. Okay. And in the present, it goes the other way, from decision down. Foundations is where the theologian states his or her own convictions, basic horizon, the statement of one's basic horizon, in terms, modern says, of intellectual, moral, and religious conversion. So one says, what is the horizon within which theological statements make sense? It's that faith as horizon that this is talking about. but also the intellectual and moral and religious conversion, because there can be a lot of differences that are not rooted in religious and moral persuasion, but that perhaps are rooted in conflicting conviction. Right. Now, out of those foundations, one arrives at one's doctrines. So doctrines here does not mean the doctrines of the church. It means theological doctrines that may be the doctrines of the church and may be the doctrines of other theologians, but they're in the second phase because I have made those doctrines my own. The doctrines of the church as arrived at by the church are studied in the first phase. But in this phase, one says, these are my positions. They may be coincident with the doctrines of the church. Well, you would hope that they are. He himself is firmly Orthodox theologian. Conservatives are angry because they can't get him on Orthodox. They love to be able to get him, but they can't. And the doctor, his doctrines, he's got a lot of doctrines of his own, but he never contradicts the dogmatic affirmations of the church with regard to Christ and the Trinity and so on. And then understanding is systematics. Systematics is an attempt to understand. So doctrines is corresponds to judgment. What do I hold to be true? Systematics to understanding. How do I understand what I hold to be true? And how do I understand it in an integrated fashion? And then finally, corresponding to experience in this phase is communication. It's the whole work of pastoral theology. Preaching, using the media, dialogue with other religions, interdisciplinary communication on the part of theology, theology attempting to establish relations with sociology, psychology, so on and so forth. Making available the data, changing the data, which subsequent generations will come along and study. What we do in our time will become material for 100 years from now, subjected to research and interpretation of history. I wanted to end with this because it shows that insight and this basic structure eventually played out into an elaborate structure of the whole discipline of theology that I think really changes the map of Catholic theology. And it does account ultimately for just about everything that the theological community does. I think the weakest chapter in the book method in theology, ironically, is the one on systematics, because that's what he taught for all those years. But he wrote it rather quickly, I think. And I think there's a lot more that needs to be said about systematics. And there are a lot more operations that theologians, systematic theologians perform than the ones that he accounts for. But still, they're all corresponding to the law. Okay, that's it. You have read a major book, and you are to be congratulated. Thank you very much. There are evaluation forms for the course which Dorothy will collect. You can stay around. Anybody that wants to, you can ask questions, but I know we're up for them. Yes, for me.
So, can you say more about doctrines, theological and church doctrines, and why is the starting point in systematic just what, theological doctrines, church doctrines?
The beginning of the chapter on doctrines in method of theology. He distinguishes primary sources, church doctrines, theological doctrines, methodological doctrine, and the application of a methodological doctrine that results in a functional specialty named doctrine. All right, the application of that method will select from the various things that are offered in dialectic You select what you hold, what you think's got to be carried forward. Now that will be a combination of doctrines of the church, theological doctrines. I will, for instance, say that Aquinas on grace and freedom as interpreted by Lonergan, that's a theological doctrine. It's not the church's doctrine. The church has never said officially that we must accept what Aquinas said. It's not a church doctrine. It's not opposed to church doctrine, but it's not a church doctrine. There are other theologies of grace.
Thanks, Mark. See you later.
So, and all of those are brought over into doctrines, okay, into the functional specialty of doctrines. It's not just the doctrines of the church. It's also the doctrines of other theologians. It's the doctrines that perhaps I've developed in the course of my own work as a theologian. I may have a position on something that is my own. And it's, you know, so people will write dissertations on Lonergan's doctrine on the supernatural or something like that. It's not the church's doctrine. It's not opposed to the church's doctrine, but it's his. It's a theological doctrine. The functional specialty of doctrines includes all of them. Okay? It includes church doctrines. It includes theological doctrines. It includes the doctrines that one may be working out for oneself. And it's not limited to the mysteries of faith. But among those, there are the mysteries of faith. And those are the principal, those constitute the principal object for systematics. And I think he's right on this, that systematics must be structured around an understanding of the mysteries of faith. That those must provide the basis for it. So that if you're going to, where do you start a systematic theology? The most influential systematic theology in the history of the church is the Summa Theologiae. The first 43 questions are on God and the mystery of God. God's existence, God's goodness, God's knowledge, God's Trinitarian nature. You start there, and then everything flows from that. And I think that's the way systematics today has got to begin to. In fact, I would begin a systematics today with the four Trinitarian relations and their corresponding creative participation. That's where I'd start a systematics. First volume would be simply filling out that structure that I gave here. Paternity, filiation, active and passive variation, and the creative participation. So I'd start there and move on from that.
So that means there are doctrines that are non-negotiable,
yes,
to start off with. That, like, it's a base before you begin.
There's a couple of things. You can distinguish a number of things here. Let me see if I've done this in any number of times, but I didn't brush up this morning. The category of doctrines, category of church doctrines. Some church doctrines express mysteries of faith that could not be known unless they were reviewed. Some church doctrines do not. They express other things, but they're not mysteries of faith. Among those church doctrines that express mysteries of faith, some have received dogmatic approbation, and others are not dogmatic. They're confessed in the creed, but they're not dogmatic. The resurrection is not a dogma. The resurrection is confessed in the creed. But there is not a dogmatic pronouncement of the church. I think there should be. And I think there may very well be. And I think we need one in our time, to be honest with you. But there has not been a dogmatic pronouncement in the church with regard to the resurrection. But it is a mystery of faith. Right? And then, so some of these, the redemption is, there's no dogma about redemption. There isn't a dogmatic pronouncement. There's a dogma about the divinity of Christ. There is a set of dogmas that gives rise to our affirmation that God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Those are mysteries of faith that have received dogmatic statement in the church. But there are other mysteries of faith, some of which we say every time we say the creed, we confess them, but they're not dogmatically defined in that sense. Creed and dogma are two different realities. Dogma is a clarification of what is confessed in faith. It's a clarification that arises almost always out of conflict. Not universally. The Marian dogmas do not arise out of conflict, but the Christological dogmas arise out of conflict. The dogmas with regard to grace arise out of conflict. Okay, now systematics is an attempt to understand all of these things plus theological doctrine. Okay, Lonergan says that systematics is really doing its it is wise for systematics to start with the dogmatic, the mysteries that have received dogmatic revelation, to start there, because the church has thought through those things more clearly. We confess the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, but what was it? What actually happened? In terms of what categories can we use to say that? We can say he's alive. He was dead and he's alive. We can say that. But do we have scientific, physical language that we can use for that? What was it? Was it transformation of matter into energy? You know, that sort of thing. What is this that allows for us to say that the one who was dead is now alive? And bodily resurrection, not simply a spiritual soul. We don't know yet. We don't have the categories. But with regard to Christological and Trinitarian stuff, 4 centuries of thinking went into clarifying these things. And I think that's non-negotiable. We might want to put it in other language today, but we can't go back on that. As John Courtney Murray said in this famous statement, having come this far, we cannot but come this far. And we have to move on from there, but we can't go back on those things.
I guess my question pertains more to the business of theology. The experience understand judgment side describes what we do. It seems like these other two are, this is what we should be doing, but not.
What?
The other two columns. Like, this is what the business of theology should look like.
Yeah.
And
But the point that he's making is that what enabled him to come up with this structure is experience, understanding, judgment, decision.
So this is then, and something, this is a call to the theologians,
yes,
to reorganize.
That's right.
How then does that, because you run into then all sorts of power structures of, well, who should be doing, who is allowed to communicate, how do you interpret certain doctrines? And I don't mean this from, I mean, yes, there's the whole big power question going on, but there's also theologians are competing against each other and aren't cooperating. Book publishers get involved in this. Conference putters, people who put on conferences get involved in this. You know, so.
Well, you know, Monica Helwig gave a lecture at Marquette University back when I was still there. The late 70s, and the lecture was called "Whose Experience Counts in Theology." Sebastian Rohr was there, and he said, "Mine, damn it!" But these are the issues, and this has always been the case. Thomas Aquinas' books were burned, shortly after his death. He fired the Archbishop of Paris, and then 50 years later, he was canonized.
Does Lonergan have a sense of where he's? Did he have a sort of a structural sense of what this theological community should be? Who did he imagine participating in this community of theologians?
All his advice to people was, if people would say, for instance, should I go into philosophy or theology? He would say, differentiate your consciousness and then do theology. Differentiation of consciousness is philosophy, it's the insight. So everybody's participating already.
They're not cooperating.
No, they're not cooperating. He says it's a framework for collaboration. It is a framework for collaboration. But
he didn't have necessarily, he didn't fill in the superstructure.
And it's a difficult thing. I don't think you reorganize a faculty of writers. so much as you you acknowledge. It's a growth in the acknowledgement of what each member of the faculty is doing, and that each one of them is making a contribution to the whole enterprise.
Do you hire on the basis?
You hire on the basis that you want every one of these things on your faculty.
Okay.
And good work in every one of these areas. If you've got a theological faculty at an advanced degree level, you want good work in every one of those areas being carried on by that faculty. And you want them harmoniously collaborating with one another. They don't have to agree on it, but you want them. I mean, the Regis faculty right now is in very good shape on this point, and that we do. I'm not sure everything that is in here is being done by us, but we are working together very well. And, but we don't all have the same basic, the same full slate of connections. There are some things that we all have in common. But you don't want fights, you know, if we can avoid them. Fights.
Where does fundraising come
from? All of the above.
That's the infrastructure. Okay, is that anything else?
I just had a kind of insight. The Jesuit formation is kind of, I don't know which ones, but the experience and understanding is basically the novitiate. You know? The first phase is experience, is the, and then reflection.
Yeah.
When you move into the philosophy and you know every kind of study, then you kind of move into this understanding of the human mind or history or
Okay.
or whatever, and then you come into the dialect
yeah.
and stuff.
Yeah.
And then when you're doing theology, you're basically working out these foundation doctrines and systematics,
yeah.
and then you move into the
communication is after that, is what you're doing as a minister
of
the gospel.
Isomorphic structure.
Yeah. As you administer the gospel, is the hermeneutic, some of the presentations of the hermeneutic circle, experience, reflect, act, I find lacking understanding. You know,
mm-hmm.
there's experience and then reflection leading to judgment and action. Insight gets neglected, you know, and I think that's what that he felt all his life. Human beings understand, and we don't pay enough attention. Have this particular act of original insight. And, it's very important in human life, but we don't pay enough attention to it.
That's what happened in science. I think that's where his background shines through, because
yeah.
we're always trying to find out what's going on here, what's happening. Before you go to the next phase. Wow.
Okay, thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It's fun.
You got your confession, or you put that on there?
That's right. It's a passport.
That's right. Put your scarf.